Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, our topic is end-of-life care and hospice. In December, the New England Journal of Medicine reported that for the first time since the early 20th century, home has become the most common place of death among Americans dying of natural causes, while deaths in nursing homes and hospitals is in decline. In a few minutes, we talk with hospice professionals and end-of-life caregivers about realities of dying at home and efforts to create a community home for the living and dying in Provincetown. But first, we bring you this story that aired last week on Morning Edition.
People in this country are thinking differently about death. Fewer Americans are dying in a hospital with the support and care of doctors and nurses. More now choose to spend their final days at home, often getting hospice care. One big reason is because Medicare has allowed more patients to qualify for this benefit. But hospice only goes so far, and the actual burden of 24-hour care falls to the families. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
Hospice usually means dying at home. And even though surveys show it's what most of us want, it's not all it's cracked up to be, says Joy Johnston.
I'm not anti-hospice at all, but I think people aren't prepared for all the effort that it takes to give someone a good death at home.
At age 40, Johnston relocated from Atlanta to New Mexico to care for her dying mother. And one intimate task tipped the scales, trying to get her mom's bowels moving. Constipation plagues many dying patients.
And it's ironically called the comfort kit that you get with home hospice. They include suppositories. And so I had to do that. And that was the lowest point. And I'm sure it was the lowest point for my mother as well. And it didn't work.
Johnston, like many family caregivers, was surprised that hospice still left most of the work to her. She says the final weeks of her mother's life, she felt more like a nurse than a daughter. Hospice primarily supports from afar, even in the intense final days when adjusting morphine doses or handling typical symptoms like bleeding and breathing trouble. And that can be scary, says Dr. Joan Tino. She's a leading hospice researcher at Oregon Health and Science University.
Imagine if you're the caregiver and that you're in the house and it's in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden your family member has a grand mal seizure.
Tino says that's exactly what happened with her own mother.
Well, it was difficult for me to witness. I knew what to do.
Tino's father, who died in the last year, went to a hospice residence with round-the-clock medical attention. Tino called it a godsend, but an inpatient facility is rarely an option. With more people spending more time on hospice, hospice has become the most profitable service sector in healthcare. For-profit agencies now outnumber the nonprofits. But they aren't building hospice units, mostly because they're not profitable. So it's on families to make do at home, and often that means hiring extra help.
You want some yogurt? Some peach yogurt? What's that?
Hospice patient Jean McCasland is sitting at the kitchen table of her home outside Nashville. Nurse aide Carrie Velez is spooning out yogurt laced with that morning's medication, ground up in a pill crusher.
Because if you don't, she will just spit them out.
Like a growing share of hospice patients, McCasland has Alzheimer's. And dementia patients need a service hospice rarely provides, a one-on-one sitter so the family caregiver can get some kind of break each day. John McCasland is Jean's husband of nearly 50 years.
I have said from the beginning that was my intention, that she would be at home through the duration, as long as I was able.
But what hospice provided wasn't enough. He had to drain their retirement accounts to hire a private caregiver out of pocket.
We were told that we would have a nurse visit once a week and more often if we wanted that.
Hospice agencies usually bring in a hospital bed, an oxygen machine, a wheelchair, whatever equipment's needed. Prescriptions show up at the house for pain and anxiety. But hands-on help is scarce. Medicare says hospice can include home health aides and homemaker services, but in practice, it's often limited to a couple of baths a week.
I don't know. I guess I've just accepted what's available and not really thought beyond what could be, because this is what they say they do.
Families rarely consider whether they're getting their money's worth because they're not paying. It's all Medicare. John even keeps his monthly statements in a three-ring binder, but he'd never taken a closer look at what's charged to the government.
That's $200 a day.
Nearly $200 every day, whether the hospice agency showed up or not. The daily rate drops a bit after the first 2 months, but John does the quick math. At that point, after Jean had been on hospice a year, Medicare had paid the agency $60,000.
When you consider the amount of money that's involved, perhaps they would provide somebody round the clock.
Far from it. Medicare data reveals that on average, a nurse or aide is only there at the house about half an hour a day. When Jean died in October, the hospice nurse showed up afterward to officially document the death. It was just John and Carrie Velez, the longtime private caregiver, who'd been by her side for several days straight. And that's pretty typical, according to Professor Catherine Ornstein.
It does take a toll.
Ornstein studies the last year of life at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and she finds the increasing burden on loved ones is reaching a breaking point.
You know, our long-term care system in this country is really using families, unpaid family members. That's our situation.
For some who've gone through home hospice with a loved one, the experience has changed their own wishes. Connie C., a social worker from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, holds up a portrait of her husband.
This is probably 5 years before he died.
He died of prostate cancer in their bedroom. Enough time has passed that the fog of managing his medication and bodily fluids, mostly by herself, has cleared. She says it was a burden.
And for me to say that, there's that guilt, you know, but I know better. It was a burden that I lovingly did.
But C was scarred, and she recently sat down her grown children to make sure they don't do the same for her.
I told my family, if there is such a thing, I will come back and I will haunt you. Don't you do that.
Their options are limited, though. Sidestepping home hospice either means a pricey nursing home or passing away with the often unnecessary chaos and cost of a hospital, which is precisely what hospice was trying to avoid. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
And joining us in studio now is Don Welsh, end-of-life doula and co-founder of the Lily House, a community home for the living and dying in Provincetown. Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
Hannah Ewart is an RN and certified hospice and palliative care nurse and co-founder of the Lily House. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us is Ellen McCabe, community relations specialist for the VNA of Cape Cod Hospice and Home Care. She's a family nurse practitioner certified in hospice. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
So we're going to unpack a lot of what we just heard in that piece. But I guess first we should mention, not all hospice is the same, right? People say, oh, you used hospice, and everybody thinks it's all the same thing, right, Ellen? You get that a lot?
Yes, because there are, I think there's 7 hospice providers right now on Cape Cod. Oftentimes, people receive care, but not necessarily aware of who they receive the care from.
And, John, I imagine there are people who are going, what is an end-of-life doula? So tell us what that is and what you do.
Sure. Thank you. It is a growing movement. So folks may have heard the term doula in association with the birth doula, and a death doula is parallel. So just as a birth doula will assist in bringing life into the world, a death doula will assist and help guide a life that is ending and transitioning out of this world. So it is holistic, comprehensive support for the dying person, but as well as for friends and family.
So we mentioned at the top of the show that more people are dying at home now than any point since the early 20th century. So what role do you think hospice has had in this change? Anybody?
I mean, I think that hospice is a philosophy, and that philosophy is meeting people where they are at end of life. And I think that as more people have realized they don't want to die in the kind of hectic environment of hospitals or nursing homes and have realized that dying at home is a possibility, we've trended towards that. And the hospice philosophy is about trying to meet people there and allowing that to happen and supporting it.
Now, people may not want to die in a hospital, but is there pressure sometimes from these institutions to move people out of beds? I mean, you know, that getting a bed in a hospital can be a tough thing sometimes. So is there this pressure to get people out of those beds?
I think there is a pressure to, or I wouldn't say it's a pressure as much as the coordination of care goes in a certain way, whether you are expected to recover for your illness or whether you're not expected to recover for your illness, that they follow a plan that involves urgent care, emergent care, finally acute care, and then what is the transition out of this environment? So I think it's especially difficult when that person is at end of life and the family is not just does not just have care needs, but emotional, psychosocial, sometimes spiritual needs that are intertwined in what that care will entail.
You know, I'm thinking, and I think I mentioned before when my father had hospice care. This was in Connecticut. It wasn't here. And I remember thinking, oh, gosh, we got to wait till he's really towards the end before we talk to hospice. I found that that's not true, right? So when do you start these conversations or even think about considering, you know, if you want hospice and you know, have those conversations about when that's appropriate?
I think you should start the conversation today.
Whether you're sick or not.
Yeah. Talk about dying. Talk about it with your loved ones. Talk about what your own expectations are. But as far as hospice goes, you know, the black and white is an expected prognosis of 6 months or less if the disease continues on its natural course. But because death is a process and it's different for everybody, really the philosophy is about identifying that decline and offering education early on in the process, encouraging people to talk about it. And then once someone is on hospice, it doesn't mean we're going to be dying within 6 months because we acknowledge that it's a process and it's different for everybody.
I was thinking of Art Buchwald from Martha's Vineyard. Remember, he talked a lot about his experience dying, and he had gone into hospice when he was, I think, in D.C. And he all of a sudden, you know, made a little bit of a recovery and was able to come back to the vineyard for the summer. And so, like you're saying, you don't know. It might be 6 months, but anything could happen, right?
Truly, we are human beings. And everybody comes with their own genetic makeup and their own trajectory through those illness. And I think that there is a lot of statistics also that says that hospice slightly increases somebody's life expectancy because some of those care needs are addressed as they come up versus waiting till they get to a severe point and then accessing care. I often say hospice is more about living the best life you can with the hand of cards you've been dealt versus the focus on the dying. But the eligibility is just as Hannah mentioned, it's just that prognostication is not an exact science. So sometimes we are caring for people for 2 or 3 days in hospice, which is much shorter than that expected prognosis. And sometimes people are recertified longer than 6 months because, again, the trajectory is not as straightforward as we thought it would be.
And if I could respond as well, I was thinking in terms of when do we start kind of talking about and preparing for death. I totally agree with Hannah, like right now, here, today, this minute. And that is a way that an end-of-life doula or community death educator can come into play because we can help community at large and individuals and groups within the community learn about what are some of the things we need to start thinking about in advance, logistical, practical things like advanced directives, but also death care planning, what may death look like, all of those kinds of things that our culture really doesn't support us to do in advance. A community death educator, death doula can help educate the community at large. So when we do get there, we are a little bit more prepared.
Yes, and the topic of death is sort of a taboo topic for a lot of people, right? So are you finding that more people are open to talking about and planning for their death than maybe a generation ago?
I think especially certain communities are extremely open and crave that information. You find that certain communities on Cape Cod, they are constantly accessing you to say, let's do another talk about this, or let's do something at the library. Let's look at being mortal. Let's look at all of these death-related issues to try to normalize it, to try to weave it into the fabric of our normal conversations. I think that oftentimes the way we delay the conversation really sort of ensures that somebody's wishes will not be met. If we want to honor somebody's wishes while they are healthy through that last point at end of life,
the only way we can honor wishes is to know what they are and to have people formally put those out in the world, not be so private about it.
It's interesting. I was thinking of an aunt and uncle who didn't have any children, and they were in their 80s at this point. And I said, What are you thinking? And they said, well, we've never talked about it. I'm like, you're in your 80s and you've never talked about this. So lucky they had that conversation. But we're talking about the reality of dying at home with hospice and end-of-life caregivers this hour. And we want to hear from you. What was your experience with hospice, or what do you wish you knew about hospice before it came time to utilize their services? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we're going to talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about living and dying in Providence on this new Lilly House that we're going to talk about in a minute, and the end-of-life care and hospice this hour. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is Dawn Welsh, end-of-life doula and co-founder of the Lilly House, a community home for the living and dying in Provincetown. Hannah Ewart, who is an RN and certified hospice and palliative care nurse, co-founder of the Lilly House, and Ellen McCabe, community relations specialist for the VNA of Cape Cod Hospice and Home Care. She's a family nurse practitioner certified in hospice. Nancy writes, in Nantucket, we have a not-for-profit palliative and supportive care of Nantucket. Our palliative care nurse and oncology nurse are supported by a vibrant volunteer program. This is key. Our volunteers effectively support the family caregivers in all ways needed. Dollar-for-dollar hospice care provides the most effective medicine of the medical world. Lawmakers need to step up reimbursement for home care. Nancy, I can tell you everybody here is nodding their head about that. Anybody have any thoughts they want to add to Nancy's comment about volunteers?
Volunteers are one of the most key parts to our program. And in fact, Medicare requires that 5% of all of the care we provide to patients and families be volunteer, not reimbursed. And I think that for the volunteer component, their specific role in the care of the seriously ill person is to remind them who they were before they were sick. So they're not asking them about the personal care situation. They're not asking them about their symptoms. They're really focusing on their meaning and purpose in life, the life they've lived, and providing companionship for the patient and respite for the caregiver.
Okay. Let's talk to Joanne, who's giving us a call from Mashpee. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I just wanted to share a little bit about my own experience with hospice. My husband passed away 2 years ago from cancer. And he had a 2-year battle with cancer. But when it came to the end of his life, I felt, and my family felt, so grateful for the support that we got from hospice. And I do want to add that Paul, my husband's name is Paul, he was able to go on to palliative care first. And this made such a difference because he probably went on palliative care maybe a couple of months before he passed, but he was feeling pretty good, as far as you can say, toward that end of life. But he was able to, the people that came to work with him were able to see his true nature and his sense of humor, so that in those last few days when he wasn't able to really talk very much, I really felt that the workers that worked with him really knew him. Mm-hmm. And I also want to mention that there was a wonderful social worker, and we worked with VNA of Cape Cod, a wonderful social worker who got in touch with my daughter and her family who were driving from Oregon to Cape Cod to be with her dad. And my grandsons were 8 at the time, and the therapist coached her on the trip as to, you know, how to support her dad and how to help the kids with their grandpa's end of life. So, yeah, I can't say enough about hospice.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, do you want to add anything else?
Well, I was just going to say that some of my extended family members also felt, like you were talking about earlier, that we were doing too much in the house, and why wasn't hospice doing more? And I didn't hear about this, of course, until after my husband had passed. They kept it to themselves. But at the same time, I felt that I knew going in because I had experienced hospice with my mother-in-law, so I knew what hospice was and was not going to be able to do, and so that did make a big difference, but my extended family, many of them, did not know. So yeah. That is an important point.
Yeah, Joanne, thank you for sharing your story. Thanks for calling in.
Okay.
Hannah, this is an interesting point. I felt clear when my dad had hospice. I was clear on what they would and would not do. And before, when you mentioned that's a big part of the job is as the hospice care person to tell people this is what we do, right?
Absolutely. I think that the responsibility is on hospice at admission or when we're doing educational informations before. We need to make sure that our language is clear, that we outline what hospice can and can't do so that families don't get ugly surprises when they are looking for extra care that hospice can't provide. And it's not that we don't want to, it's that there are just some things that aren't covered by the hospice benefit. And I'm so grateful to hear that story about a wonderful social worker, because social workers can help in allowing families to access things like 24/7 care. It's out there. It's available. Hospice can't be there 24/7 in your house, but we can help you find those resources.
So most people, go ahead.
Oh, and one of those resources could be a community home, such as the Lilly House. If we kind of go back to the story at the top of the hour, and what we're talking about here is there are situations where hospice isn't enough. Families feel a burden of care, and the options currently presented, you know, is going into a facilitated care or to hire private care at home, both of which can be cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. And then kind of some solutions offered are expanding palliative care in general. And like the caller just suggested, you know, increasing funding for a wider range of care and longer duration of care. And although those solutions offered, I think, definitely would help, I think it's important to recognize that those current solutions that are kind of put on the table at the story in the top of the hour and with the caller fall within the same paradigm of care. That is, it's a care that is medical industry focused and monetary based. And what I would suggest we consider would behoove us to consider perhaps of a whole paradigm shift from a medical industry focused monetary-based care model to a community-based pay-it-forward model, mm-hmm. which is exactly what the Lilly House is proposing to do. And with that, I think that it could lead us to a whole change of narrative in dying from an individual burden of care to an opportunity, not a burden of care, but an opportunity for community care, where we come together as community, as friends, as family, and we take this opportunity to care for each other at the end of life. And we do that by the community, for the community, relying heavily on community volunteers as a way to honor the lives that we've shared at the end of life.
All right. So tell us about Lilly House. Go ahead, Hannah.
So the Lilly House is it's a vision for a community home for living and dying, just as Dawn said. It's not a hospice like what we're talking about. It's not a Medicare funded. It's a nonprofit vision, and it's we envision a home just like, you know, when we talk about we want to die at home, but it's hard to die at home. Our thought is, well, why can't we build a home for dying on Cape Cod and have all the amenities of home, have kitchens, have gardens, have living spaces, and then have quiet, calm bedrooms without beeping IVs and call lights and mm-hmm. kind of the hubbub that you get in more skilled settings, but truly a home environment with volunteers, with nursing staff, and then hospice as that supplemental support that it's meant to be. Hospice coming in with the equipment, the meds, all those things that were mentioned at the story. Hospice can still bring those into a community home, but it'll be more of a collaborative effort because this will be a home for dying.
Right.
And go ahead. Oh, in terms of jumping off the kind of collaborative nature of the Lilly House and other such community homes for living and dying is that we would provide this 24/7 hospice level continuum of care that it's hard for families to provide on their own. So the Lilly House would provide that with paid professional staff as well as trained community volunteers. And so if we think about the comfort care, things like, you know, just grooming, personal assistance, massage, Reiki, you know, we would work with community volunteers to come into the Lilly House and provide those services, bedside music and song.
That's where I would want to die.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, coming back to this idea of what is a doula and what is exactly doula assistance and support. So the Lilly House, we would offer this sort of doula support and assistance in the form of education, helping the dying and their friends and family understand what is happening and helping to reduce worry and fear and anxiety around the whole process. And then even after death care, I think it's important for us, we're kind of focusing on hospice and pre-death care and comfort. I think it's important that we also bring into this conversation after death care. There's a way that the Lilly House will offer support and assistance for us to take care of our own dead and be as hands-on as we want to be, and then to also offer bereavement support for friends and family after our residents at the Lilly House have passed. So it's very comprehensive in scope.
Yeah. Let's talk to Tom Callahan, who's calling in. He's the Executive Director of Hospice on Martha's Vineyard. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Mindy. Thank you for taking my call. Amy had given us a head up the topic was going to happen, and then I spoke to the Lilly House for the first time, I think, 2 days ago.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what happens on the vineyard.
Well, we are an odd duck in the sense that we are, out of choice, a non-Medicare hospice. There's about three of us left in the country where we offer hospice nursing, bereavement counseling to our hospice and non-hospice families, expected death, unexpected death, to the entire island community. We do not, we have a staff of 13 who are paid. We do not have a billing department, so we do not bill insurance, any insurance, or patients for any of our services. I just tell people we do lots of bake sales, you know, to make this happen. So we're very blessed and privileged to be able to offer the model that we do, since it really leaves the choice with our, we feel, with the patient and their families about making choices around their care.
Yeah. So Tom, are the services pretty similar to what we've been talking about with the other hospice providers?
Yes, our clinical director, Chantel Patterson, is on the other line. We tried doing speaker, but then Dan said it doesn't work so well. And she could speak to, because she comes from a Medicare hospice background, and then moved here to the Vineyard and started to work for us as our clinical director. So she would be the best person to speak around that comparison. Mm-hmm. But as far as, you know, of my work here and comparing it to the Medicare regulations and what the benefits are, they're very, very similar. And we go up and beyond with a number of different funds that we have to support our families that are, you know, in addition to what Medicare would typically offer.
Yeah. So Ellen, the VNA of Cape Cod, you work with the Vineyard too as well?
Yes. Yeah. So, hi, Tom. This is Ellen.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. The VNA Hospice is the Medicare certified hospice that works collaboratively on Martha's Vineyard. And there are times that Hospice of Martha's Vineyard and our hospice do education together. Sometimes we share clinical expertise on patients with each other and do things at the hospital together. Yeah, so it's a nice relationship.
Tom, thanks for calling in. I'm going to move on to Chantel, who's the clinical director.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Chantel, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, sure. So I was asking Tom the question about the services and how they compare to the other hospice services we have here. So is it the same thing?
So essentially, we really try to mimic the same benefits that the Medicare hospice does offer. So we offer nursing support, counseling, both pre-bereavement and bereavement. We offer spiritual care. We're led by a medical director. One of the major differences we don't offer is home health aides. That is something that comes with the Medicare benefit. But we've actually found that on the island that that works in our favor because there's such a shortage out here that most of our home health aides are private duty, and we're able to connect them with our families in need and help pay for them through grants and fundraising rather than through an insurance benefit. Yeah. So we can actually put the resource to use where it's most needed.
That's pretty amazing that you can get the funding for that and you meet the need, right? You are able to help everybody who comes to you?
As best we can. We've had to we're really trying to mimic, again, the Medicare benefit as far as eligibility goes, because as you can imagine, in an aging population, right. The need just keeps growing and growing, and so we have to be careful with our own resources as well. And, it seems as the calls come in that almost every household could use a hospice nurse in there in one way or another. And so we have had to narrow down our eligibility and really educate the community about what hospice is and when it's appropriate for hospice to be there. But also help connect them with the other resources that are available when it's not appropriate for hospice.
Right. Chantel, thanks for being with us and filling us in on what happens on Martha's Vineyard. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Sue is calling from Sandwich. Hi, Sue. Nope, Sue's not there. All right. All right. So our ideas of, dying peacefully at home surrounded by loved ones, how does that compare to the reality of dying at home?
Dying is hard.
Yeah.
Dying is a very personal process. I think that there's a lot of perspectives on dying and maybe misconceptions, just from TV and movies. And I think that sets people up for an expectation of what dying at home is going to look like. And as a hospice nurse, I want to do everything in my power to get that peaceful death for my patients. I want the family to be present. I want us to all have a wonderful moment. But
that doesn't always happen.
It doesn't always happen. People are individuals, and this process is so personal. And I think that the best, most important thing we can do as, hospice nurses, again, as early as possible, is have that conversation and provide educational materials. There's so much information out there so that people can understand what they might see. And by being able to identify it, we can respond to it before it becomes a crisis.
Right. Yes. So I want to just underscore what Hannah said about death is work. Mm-hmm. It is hard work for the dying person, and it is hard work for their friends and family. And that's why the Lilly House, in addition to providing its core services to the dying residents and their friends and family, we will also have a community death education component to exactly address these needs and concerns. So we will offer community workshops to anyone to come to learn about, what is the dying process? Well, what is hospice? How do you get on it? What should we, who pays for it? What is something, I've heard this concept, nearing death awareness. What is that? Educating ourselves in our community about these things to help us prepare. So yes, death is hard work, but we will be better prepared to meet that hard work when it comes.
And you talk about it being a person, it's very different. And I'm just thinking back to my experience with my father. Mm-hmm. My sister and I and one brother would go into the bedroom. The rest of my siblings, the boys, would not. They were there, but they could not bring themselves to come into the bedroom, which I found really interesting because, you have this vision that we're all going to react to this the same way, and we don't, right?
Yeah. Do they regret that?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. They you know, I had one brother who didn't come to the house at all, but he called and would talk to him on the phone. And I think it was they were afraid of their own emotions, mm-hmm. you know, how they would, they didn't want to upset anything by them being upset. I don't know. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that the family perspective that was in the piece that we heard at the beginning of the program was really very thoughtful, and to hear the perspectives of what hospice care is in different parts of the country, I do agree with everyone that there's no way to underscore what that impact on the caregiver is. Right. But if we don't pay close attention to that caregiver, to their coping, to their needs, to the shifting needs of the patient, to stay ahead of those, that if we lose the caregiver, we lose everything.
Right.
So that we constantly are giving people the opportunity to say, is this really working for everyone? And to try to relieve any feelings of guilt if it isn't a right fit. It's not right for everyone. And sometimes if you aren't bringing the best part of you to the best part of them, mm-hmm. it is really important to be able to recognize it and say, we can move you to another safe place where you could be the wife again.
Right.
You mm-hmm. could be the husband again. You could be the child again if the caregiving responsibility has got you so stressed or anxious or losing sleep.
And I think that's where, you know, these community home models come into play, right? Instead of going to a facility, you can come to a home environment and we can share that burden, right? And so I think it will help shift this narrative, the story at the top of the hour mentioned this feeling that hospice is moving into this situation of using unpaid family members, and that's feeling overly burdensome. But if we offer community homes and community care and support, we can shift that narrative to not using families, but actually supporting families.
Right, right.
And that's the beauty of community care at end of life.
Let's talk to Sue, who's calling from Sandwich. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to, we had used hospice when my husband was at the end of his life. He had brain cancer. And one thing that I don't know if I didn't really understand at the time, but I think it's important, is he had started to have really horrible seizures. And he had one, and I called 911, and they came, took him to the hospital, and the hospital could not treat him because he was under hospice care.
Did he have
did
he have a do not resuscitate order or something like that in place?
Well, we did, mm-hmm. yes. I mean, he was just having grim seizures, but the doctors at the ER said that they could not treat him because we were under hospice care.
Yeah, so they're looking very puzzled around the room here, shaking their heads no. You guys want to say? Yeah.
Well,
go ahead, go ahead, Ellen.
Sue, I'm so sorry for your experience with that. We have the capability to provide hospice wherever the person is. So in that circumstance, if somebody has a seizure, which would be obviously related to their hospice benefit, they could be made a general inpatient in the hospice, in the hospital under hospice. So the hospice care providers would go to the hospital and provide that care. The only caveat is if the hospice did not have a contract with the hospital. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, it can be seamless, and then we can work to get that person back home if they want to. Your situation makes me think of how excited we are that the McCarthy Care Center will be reopening, because sometimes that can also be an alternative where somebody needs acute care but wants to really receive it in an environment where their hospice wishes are supported.
Yeah.
So I am sorry for your experience,
yeah.
Sue.
Yeah, Sue, thank you for calling. We're going to talk about the McCarthy House, but let's take a break first. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the reality of dying at home with hospice and end-of-life care this hour. We'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626. What was your experience with hospice? What do you wish you knew before? 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Dawn Welsh, end-of-life doula and co-founder of the Lily House, a community home for the living and dying in Provincetown. Hannah Ewart, who is an RN and certified hospice and palliative care nurse, co-founder of the Lily House, and Ellen McCabe, Community Relations Specialist for the VNA of Cape Cod Hospice and Home Care. She's also a family nurse practitioner certified in hospice. All right, so the MacArthur House, we talked a little about the Lilly House, and I think some people may remember the MacArthur House, which closed, right? It was in Sandwich, and it closed in December of 2018. It's set to reopen. So tell us a little bit about the MacArthur House.
So the MacArthur Care Center is a hospice general inpatient unit. So just as we mentioned about that care can be provided at some place like Liberty Commons, a skilled nursing facility can be provided at the hospital, and it can also be provided at a self-standing general inpatient unit. So the MacArthur Care Center is on Service Road between exit 3 and 4, and it is a 10-bed acute care facility with nursing and hospice aides 24/7 with daily medical care. So either a nurse practitioner or a physician is there on a daily basis. And the care is provided in a home-like environment. All the rooms are private with a little deck that people can go out of. That the deck is actually large enough to push a hospital bed out on it so people could still feel nature.
How much of a demand is there for hospice homes, and what is the criteria for people to be admitted?
Well, for a community-based hospice home that we're talking about with the Lilly House, to get on hospice in general, as Hannah mentioned at the top of the show, is a diagnosis of 6 months or less to live. And as Hannah also noted, that that can often extend, right? Because
It's not an exact science.
And so it's not uncommon for a life to extend beyond the original 6 months. So coming into the Lilly House or other such community-based social model hospice homes would require a diagnosis of 3 months or less to live, because chances are at that point it really will be your final months of life. And the Lilly Home, the Lilly House is set up for end-of-life care.
Sue just wrote in, Sue, who was just on it, she says, I just was on the show and I wanted to say something else. I wanted to tell you that I had the most beautiful experience with the hospice nurse right after Jeff passed. We bathed his body together, and I'll always be thankful for that experience. Thank you. So, Sue, thank you. Sorry we didn't get you to keep you on long enough to tell us that. But a lot of people who have hospice experiences are really thankful. I think the same thing. The hospice nurse that we had with Mother, she was wonderful. And I think this goes to what you were saying, Hannah, about knowing what they're doing, but also, you know, she would give us this is what death looks like. Mm-hmm. These are the things you need to look for, and ways that we could make him comfortable. And the whole conversation of it's okay to go. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, which is because some people will just hang on and hang on. And it sounds so simple, but saying, you know, it's OK, you can go. And then it's like this peace that comes over them. All of these conversations, how would we know that otherwise? Right. I mean, I've never saw death before. Right. So these are all the things that these hospice nurses do.
Absolutely. And as a hospice nurse, you know, and or death doulas, we have to remind ourselves what is normal to us, something that we see as part of our work, is a very individual, brand new, and often
scary,
sad, risky of being negative experience. And our role is to try to normalize it, try to identify the positives, and of course, try to manage symptoms. Dawn mentioned near-death awareness, and I'm sure that was something that your nurse prepared you for, where all of a sudden your loved one says, you know, hey, I got a bus to catch. Yeah. Oh, I got to pack my bag. We got to go somewhere. And you're thinking, where are we going? What are we doing? It's because the brain is telling the body, we're about to go on an incredible journey. And the body is just kind of trying to catch up the only way it knows how. Oh, I'm going on a trip. I better pack.
Yeah.
And these are things that I think family members might not recognize, or they might think, oh, good, you know, grandma's kind of bouncing back. Right. She's talking about going on a trip. And our responsibility as end of life care providers is to normalize that and to prepare you, because it can mean that we might be in the days of, you know, we might be in the last few hours sometimes.
You just can't tell, right?
And we get that rally, and we should be celebrating that moment. Right.
Hospice started as a volunteer enterprise, but there are now, as we mentioned, for-profit and not-for-profit hospice options. Is there a difference between the two in terms of care? Excuse me, Karen?
I would like to just say, just because Tom and Chantel called before, so what they are currently doing is how we all started. Mm-hmm. I know I initially was, my first boss was Mary McCarthy at Hospice of Cape Cod. We all started before the Medicare Hospice Benefit as providers where the community supported that effort. As hospice shifted and the Medicare Hospice Benefit came into play, people started to go, if it matched what the community need was, to become certified. And then beyond that, other models of hospice have come up. You could be a hospice that is part of a skilled nursing group. You could be a hospice that's part of a home care or a hospital system. You could be for-profit. You could be not-profit. It is all very very different models, but we provide essentially
same
hopefully the same care.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about hospice, would your advice be to talk to different hospice organizations?
100%.
Absolutely.
Yes. I would say you want to talk to the staff. You know, there's usually an admissions nurse or someone that, you know, they're more than happy to come and meet you, but do your homework, do your research. You know, one thing that Broadreach Hospice does is we ask what matters most when we do an admission or an educational piece. And the idea is to try to identify what's important to the patient, to their families. And I think that that's something that everyone should consider if they're looking at hospice. What matters most? And then keep that in your mind as you're talking to different hospices to identify who can best meet your needs. You know, in the story that we heard, you know, Ellen and I were talking a little bit about, you know, a family member administering a suppository with nothing but coaching over the phone. And I know the nurses that I work with are exceptional.
Yeah,
they would never.
Same with us.
They would hang up and say, I'm on my way over. You know, like that's, I think that's just a reflection of the quality of care, and not a reflection of whether it's for-profit or not-profit.
Right. Absolutely.
And I'd like to respond to Ellen's important point about the origins of hospice starting out in a very grassroots, community-based model. And again, I think it's important to talk about the ways that a community home like the Lilly House will work with hospice that is akin to the original work of hospice, right? So that to stay at the Lilly House or any other community home for living and dying, you do need to be enrolled with a Medicare funded hospice organization to provide that clinical medical need, right, that the Lilly House will not provide. And in doing so, hospice can be brought into the fold of community care, right? So the top of the story, our story was talking about you know, hospice being not enough. But with this community-based model, hospice now shifts to more than enough, to an enhancing role, not a lacking role.
Right. Yeah.
And that's really the beauty of this model, working in close collaboration with medical hospice providers. Yeah. So we are all doing this work together.
So you are being the caregiver, and hospice is coming in just like we would come in to anybody else's home as collaborative
exactly.
add-on to the care yeah. that's already being provided.
Exactly.
We are at the end of the hour, but real quickly, when will the Lilly House open?
As soon as we find a property. So you listeners out there, we need your support. If you know of a property, it's not uncommon in this model for homes to be gifted for this use, and we are putting that out there.
So you're looking for a property. All right. So
find us, the Lilly House.
All right. Don Welsh, Hannah Ewart, and Ellen McCabe, thank you all for being here. We're going to post links with more information about the Lilly House and the other hospice providers on the Cape and Islands at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you all for being here and for the
Thanks,
work that
Mindy.
You do.
Thank you
so
much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.